You are listening to the Poetry Saloncast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. The Poetry Salon is on a mission to make inspiration, education, and an inspiring community affordable and available to poets and writers around the world. To find out more about our workshops, classes, editing services, and events, visit www.thepoetrysalon.com. Now, please enjoy our interview with this week's guest poet.
Becoming a mink whale, underwater she endures, attempts to create a viable future in shifty green among other whores and feminists, akin to frilled sharks in cabaret. The angler in grotesque horniness, her obsessions over hairy antennae oscillating in the dark. Above, parties of war continue. On land, what's there to need? Mud, stool, the salacious heat. Certainly, she has mended enough quilts in cotton to comfort her lover's body during late, rough nights. No more rice or pickled cinquamas or the goat knuckle stew that she fed the soldiers in their heavy boots. Who stole all her spoons and pretty effigies, their mouths stuffed with porridge and belly meat. Let her have ocean, gargantuan, iridescent, kaleidoscoping to the Black Sea. Map, clock, contract, kill, they all mean something different down here. She'll gulp oysters and mussels down with no desire for palm wine. She'll read books floating on her side, spectral algae tickling her brain and wanted curvy fat. In that unreachable sky, some human might describe as precious or turquoise, she knows paradise lives elsewhere. And the second poem I'll read an excerpt from, is titled Cut, an Opening to Mend the Me. At midnight, I flip through old political cartoons from a giant book, rummage through family photos, then watch Filipino neorealist films from Braca, Del Mundo, Bernal, Raya Martin, lodged between fragments of memories and war stories my family kept hidden. Self-narration only goes so far. From a letter sent to me more than 10 years ago, the writer explains, reimagination and subversion should be inherent in any Filipino work given our histories. I am surprised when folks try to abide by the normative. If assimilation is erasure, then survival is innovative. Queer and diasporic Filipinx bodies been seen as reproduction, fetish, anachronism, unqualified good. Dislocation inevitably leads to adapting a praxis of forgetting. But with forgetting comes reimagination, hybridity of diasporic queerness materializes as polyphonic quiver, as korlong, as zither, as harp, as dystopian lyric. To classify as anything but singular is an intervention, a bridge between migration and when trauma exposes the hybridity of the self. It exposes the multiple, often incompatible.
You've been listening to the poetry of Angela Peña Redondo. Born in Iloilo City, Philippines, Angela Peña Redondo is a queer Filipinx writer, interdisciplinary artist, educator, and scholar. Peña Redondo is the author of Nature Felt But Never Apprehended, Noemi Press, All Things Lose Thousands of Time, Inlandia Institute, winner of the Hilary Gravendike Regional Prize, and Maroon from Jammy Publications. Peña Redondo's work has appeared in the Academy of American Poets, Pleiades, Black Warrior Review, Southern Humanities Review, and elsewhere. Peña Redondo has received fellowships from Hedgebrook, Kundiman, Mana, Voices of our Nation's Art, and Macondo. They have also received awards from Tin House, Community of Writers, and others. They are an assistant professor of creative writing and digital humanities at California State University, San Bernardino. Currently, Peña Redondo lives in Los Angeles, Gabrielino Tongva land. Angela, it's great to see you. And I know we have come in contact before through LA, living in LA. I think I probably met you at Idlewild Arts. Does that ring true?
I think that rings really true. Thank you for reminding me about Idlewild. And yes, we did meet in person. And I believe it is Idlewild. Idlewild is such a beautiful place to meet other communities, other writers in the community in Los Angeles, for sure. It's such a beautiful place.
Yeah, I think I've met a number of writers there, and then we get off the mountain and I'll see them around, or I'll, you know, see them around on Facebook and social media and be all like, you know, LA is such a big place. I could live in LA for years and probably never meet you in person, but because of meeting you in that small little community up there at Idlewild Arts, like I've always kind of had my antenna trained on you on social media, and like I know that. I know that they're out there writing poetry and stuff. So, I'm really glad we get to actually talk and have a conversation about poetry. And yeah, thank you so much for being here. Can you remind me again, when exactly was this book released?
Thank you so much for inviting me, Trisha. It's such a pleasure to be part of this podcast and to be finally in conversation with you since Idlewild. So this Nature Felt But Never Apprehended was just released this year, March 2023, on Noemi Press.
And this is your third book. I was looking at the titles, and the one about everything loses thousands of times, I just said, yeah, that's the story of my life. So I'm gonna have to check that one out as well pretty soon. But I do want to talk mainly about this one. And before we get into this book specifically, do you want to say a little bit about how you got into poetry in general and, you know, your origin story as a poet?
Yeah, that's always a really tough question to kind of unpack and to think about and relive again, but I'm happy to talk about it. So I would say my journey into writing poetry started probably when I was in high school, 15, you know, when I was 15 years old. I would say it came really naturally, although I wasn't aware that I was writing poetry. I was just journaling, but I would have multiple ledgers and I was writing voraciously. It was such a sanctuary for me as a teenager, as a young adult, with all the you know, challenges and craziness that was happening then. This was like, what is this? This was like the, I don't know, probably the early 90s. And so, and dealing with a lot of, you know, for lack of a better word, a lot of coming of age stuff. And so that's when I started writing. However, my parents, being traditional first generation, you know, immigrant parents, they were really apprehensive about me pursuing poetry or creative writing. I don't think even creative writing was a word that was a thing or was an existence to me at that time. So I had to try something else, which was weird because I ended up studying art. And I don't know why. I mean, like, I knew why I chose art, because I was a creative person and I needed to go down that route where I felt I was the strongest. But also I was lucky enough to have teachers, like every now and then when I was going to City College, that encouraged me, that planted seeds in my brain and my mind. And so I did that. I studied art, but I was always writing in the back burner. I was always still reading and writing all the time. And then I would say a pivotal moment that shifted where I was like, okay, let me pursue this a little bit more seriously was when I was already graduated. I was already working full time and I was working for an arts education nonprofit. And the poet, Will Alexander, and I was really young at that time, and I mean, Will was well known, but he definitely has much more, he presence and notoriety now. He recommended and suggested and helped me get the scholarship for this writer's extension program at UCLA, and so I did that and met other instructors there, and I think after a couple years of doing that and also just working a lot of like nonprofit work or like social justice, community oriented work, I was just really exhausted. And I thought, let me just like, MFAs are a thing, like MFAs actually exist. I wasn't thinking I was going to get a job afterwards or anything, but I thought if I could just write for 2 years, then maybe this is a thing that I need. And I almost thought of it like as a 2 year residency because I really was like, I've been working not in creative writing or as a writer for already a few years before I went back to graduate school. So I didn't have any illusions that I would find a job, and I thought that would be a safe place or state of consciousness to be in. And so that's when I decided to take my MFA and I went to UC Riverside. And I applied to all various schools and I ended up there. And that's when things started to change and I started to meet mentors and folks that really supported my work. And it was after that program where I was able to write All Things Lose thousands of times and was selected by Inlandia pretty much I think the year after I graduated. And so that's how everything else kind of, evolved after that.
Who were some of your mentors and influencers as you were finding your own poetry voice?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. I would have to like look back. I would have to go into my mental Rolodex. And so when I was, I can talk about my mentors then, but I would say that in terms of UC Riverside, Allison Hedge Koch and Michael Jaime were like very, they provided a lot of support and mentorship for me. There was also like dear friends of mine that I have a lot of love and respect for. And the way they just read my work very carefully, and they were just very supportive in terms of their research and subject matter that I was pursuing, the kind of style and aesthetics of poetry that I was invested in, and they were always giving me these new perspectives. And but while I was at UCR, I also had the opportunity to work with Chris Abani and Juan Felipe Herrera, who also influenced my work. There was a couple other people I would say in UC Riverside was Fred Moten, who I was reading. UC Riverside has an interdisciplinary program, so we were encouraged to do more than one study in medium and integrate it into our poetics. So I was reading Fred Moten's work and studying with him. And then later on, I really started to gravitate towards other writers who were writing in a really kind of hybrid, literary hybrid, interdisciplinary style. Probably the first poet that I encountered was Banu Kapil, back then, who I was very, very much into. And I had the opportunity to work with when I was at, when I was doing one of Naropa's summer programs and also during one of her workshops that she did many years ago.
So tell me a little bit now about this book. I'm correct, right? This is the third one.
Yes.
So congratulations.
Thank
Fantastic.
you.
Tell me a little bit about the genesis of this book. When did you know it was a collection? And could you say a little bit about what holds this one together as a collection?
Sure. I probably realized that it was a collection or there was potential that it was a manuscript during the pandemic, right? I think a lot of folks produced during the pandemic. A lot of artists were finding all these alternative ways to be generative and to be productive. And in the beginning, for me, it was not like that. I felt like I was a really not a very productive or generative artist. I just wanted to kind of just exist and be comfortable and survive that time. But also, one of the things I think, because I was in a more isolated, like many people, more isolated state, there was a lot of reflection and struggle to be present than I normally would if I would if I was, commuting and teaching and doing all of that and being in constant community and activation with others. So that time of isolation helped me reflect a lot on the works that I had that went into this manuscript. And I also had the opportunity, or more of an opportunity, to read books during the pandemic. So 2020, I would say 2020, 2021. And so that's when I felt, okay, like I do have something. I have a lot of work here. And I was able to see the, I guess, thematic threads, or that the kind of connective tissues in the work. And also in terms of books, I really like it when books are able to have sort of multiple connective fibers and not just one. And I think it makes the book a lot more rich and also complex. And I thought, I have something like that. I have something that has the potential to go there. And I am rarely, in a place, even mentally and emotionally, to just look at like singular, or even, like I have to have like three or more themes going on. And so I realized that. But also, one of the things that was that also motivated me was Noemi Press. And I have a lot of gratitude for Noemi, because one of the editors, Diana Artirian, has always been supportive of my work, or very encouraging of my work. And she was following my work as it evolved, since All Things Lose thousands of times. And she was already kind of knocking on my door and saying, do you have a manuscript? Is something ready? And I would always say, no, nothing. I don't have anything. And then finally she asked me again, and I was like, you know what? I have something. And
Right.
so yeah. So d I would say definitely there was a lot, there was encouragement from the editors at Noemi.
Yeah, and that's always, of course, something to be wished for. I guess it's also something that could trip you up too if you're not ready for it.
Yes.
So for the I'm glad you put it that way, that your work has complexity and several themes weaving in at once. As I was reading your book, and I'll just be honest, I keep doing this to myself where I read books when I know I have a deadline, and I'm always going, why did I wait so long? I need to have time to read that a second time. I finish one poem and I go, I really want to go back and read it again from the beginning, but I don't have time. I've got to, and I'm with some folks, it's harder. You definitely need more time. I feel like with your poems, I absolutely owe myself a second reading of the collection and of individual poems, because there is so much complexity. There's so many interesting turns and, lines that would stick out to me, but then I go, well, how did she get to that? I'm like, well, how did the speaker get to that line? So I'd read a poem and come to a line that just, devastated me, and I wanted to highlight it and put stars next to it, and then I go, how did the speaker get to that line? And I found myself doing that with a number of your poems. For someone who hasn't read the book yet, just window shopping for poetry books, what would you say are the main themes that you were exploring in this collection?
Yeah, so originally the book started off with stories in my family history, mostly untold stories and stories I had to kind of dig up, but also stories that were shared. It was a combination of both. It was war stories during World War II stories during the Japanese occupation in the Philippines. And so where my grandfather was a guerrilla soldier, and so was my uncle at that time. And so there are these stories that I think many Filipinos or Filipinx people have heard, as they were growing up, during that time. I don't know if the younger generation is remembering these stories, but I think they are, because they're kind of almost like they become almost like mythological, even though war is like real. But they become mythological almost because they happened so long ago, and the way they were told, especially when they're passed down from, like parent or family member to family member.
Sorry, that's really interesting. The idea that, a story becomes mythological, partially because of the repetition, partially because it happened so long ago. And then I would also imagine just because the conflict, a war is so intense, it gives it almost another worldly kind of quality to it.
Yes, yeah, thank you for saying that, for sure. And also it's and every time, and I think also, like, because it's a memory passed down too in a story, they're like, I'm sure it's changed. The memory of the story kind of changes. And so it that's where I guess the inspiration started, was those stories. And I started researching and reading about that time and doing I was just doing a lot of research, and both of my grandparents on my patrilineal side have pa all four of my grandparents have passed, but my grandparents that I was the closest to, who were much more involved in the war, I guess, or who were part of the military in the war, passed. And so as I was doing family research history, and also just like cultural history, it started to become really overwhelming, as research does, and also really violent, and a violent history, and really sad. But also, like, there was a lot of self-reflection that I had to do. And so when so that's how the book started, was I was looking at those stories, and even like becoming a mink whale, the first poem that I read, that actually was originally titled Why My Grandmother Became a Mink Whale, and got edited down to Becoming a Mink Whale. And so it started there, and then we had the pandemic, and then we had the pandemic and all the uprisings, right? All the political stuff that was part of the pandemic that charged that time. And it was like I could still write about it, but I had to incorporate more. Because I was being so affected, like everybody, I was being so affected by at that time. And so I had to do a lot of, again, like deep reflecting, and also sort of creative outpouring, in terms of like just kind of writing or reading. And so I started to open up the scope, not just sort of a historical thing, but also sort of a personal thing. And I wanted it also to reflect, like, how do these stories that I've heard, in the family, or that have been passed down, how do they affect me now? Where am I now? And so that book strives to explore that, and also looking back.
I think that's incredibly useful to consider. One of the secrets of this podcast, we could also call it, Trisha Gets an Education in Writing Poetry too, because I am always coming to these interviews as not just a reader of poetry, but a writer of poetry, always wanting to know how I can learn and grow. I'm also working on a book that definitely is about real life events that took place in the past. And I have to ask myself frequently, like, well, it's not dead. How is it still relevant? How is it still alive? Why is it important to learn about it? Not just kind of this distant conceptual, you should know what your past is, but like why? And with your poetry collection, it all feels very visceral, very urgent, very charged. I think that's the word I would land on, is like there's a charge that feels very immediate. This is not nostalgically reviewing something. So can you say a little bit about, what you came to as you were writing, and if you were to answer that question about how is it still relevant, what would you say?
Well, first I would say again, like I really appreciate the help that I had from my editors. I had the opportunity and the privilege to work with, wonderful editors, as Susie Garza, but also Diana Artieri, and spent a lot of time helping me look at the manuscript, look at the book, and providing editorial suggestions. It was vital for me to also share parts of the book or the manuscript with other writer friends that I trust, whose work and research also align with mine in various ways. So folks like Muriel Lung, who came out with the book Imaginus, The Swarm. On Naipo came out in 2022, or was it 21? 2000. It was the most. It was the last recent Naipo, I think, book prize. And so, folks like that were able to help me, support me, in coming to terms for with like what the book was not really about, but help me think about what it might, the things that it might be about, and its relevancy. And I feel like putting a book together, yes, a lot of the work is solitary, but it can really evolve in such significant ways when you are working with others, whether it's a large community or even just one or two trusted people, right? And especially trusted people who are also familiar with the subject matter and the research that you're, writing in. So I would say that's what happened, with the book. In terms of like my own ex personal experience and transformation, I think just like any manuscript, there was a bit of like a cleanse. It felt like a cleansing process to do it, because there's so much work that you're, or research or work or stuff that you're consuming to either generate or to revise or to edit. So there was a lot of, me taking in information and then having to clear it out so I
Please
can
talk more
refine.
about
Yeah.
please talk more about that. That's that's exciting for me to hear. I think I'm frequently in my writing hoping that I'm going to clear something out and walk away a little bit lighter. Sorry,
Yeah,
go
go
ahead.
ahead. No. Well, again, so like, right, like whether one goes to a workshop, right, or has a friend look at the work, I think some of the most helpful feedback is when, not just line edits, to be honest with you. I mean, line edits are great. When I get line edits, I'm like, wow, fabulous. But also like when I'm given questions, like I'm so interested in like the questions that other readers come up with when they're reading like unre like raw or work in progress work. So the questions help me launch into a kind of reseeing, let's say reseeing a long piece or a poem or a hybrid prose or whatever. It just helps me resee it and work through it. I also like to shuffle things around. There's a lot of shuffling that I do. I shuffle the lines around, I shuffle the pages around. If I'm really, I guess, stuck or feeling stuck or wondering what the issue is, then I will read. I'll read something else. Like I'll go to, I'll try to again go through some kind of like either mental or physical like file in my brain or outside, and I'll see where did this come from, and see if I can do further research. And somehow, trust is so weird because sometimes you feel like you're in this abyss. But trust that I'll find something. And eventually you find some key things, right? They can be themes or words that you can take in and use. And I'm really into the pastiche. Even though there's some works in here that I was really trying hard to sound much more direct or prosaic, I know my language is like very dense, or I'm aware of that, or it can get that way. And so there are moments that I will try to just say it as plainly as I can, And so I think when a writer also gets to know or accept or understand the multiple voices that we have,
Yeah.
the multiple ways in which our voices come out through our writing, I think is also can be really transformational because then it allows us to speak in more than one like tone, right?
Yes.
And just having to say we have to sound like this way. I hope that makes some kind of sense or
Absolutely. And I want to ask a little bit more about research.
yeah.
There's some books I think that absolutely demand it, especially if you are writing about historical things. There's some books that I know people write probably without ever cracking the encyclopedia or doing, any kind of research outside of themselves. So can you talk a little bit about some of the research you did? Was there anything you've discovered that was, really surprising that that you think we should know about?
Yeah, I did a lot. I did a lot of research for this book. And there's an endnotes page in the back, which I like
Yes.
redo to endlings. And so it kind of definitely points to the amount of research that I was doing. And a lot of the research wasn't always, let's just say, like for the book. Like I didn't just say, okay, I'm gonna do research for the book. I also was pulling like experiences and interests whenever I have an opportunity to quote unquote get away. It doesn't always have to be on a residency or something, but when I do ha like have an opportunity to see some art, go to a museum, see some art or take a walk in nature somewhere. I try to be as receptive as I can. It's almost like I have a little tiny antenna or something in the back that if I do find information that feels relevant or feels interesting, then I'll try to capture it. It's almost like being open to the clues or to the signs. And so I do a lot of that. I wrote this little micro essay for the Poets and Writers or Recommend series on like, writing, like writing exercises or, how do you write? And there's a part of my writing creative writing process that's kind of magic-like, or I tap into that part where I'm not so much thinking and I'm not tapping into that more cerebral in intellectual part of my brain. I'll tap into something else, whether we want to call it more like your intuition, whether we want to call it prayer, where we were whether we want to call it magic or what have you. But where I let some other thing speak to me other than my maybe we would call it our rational brain.
Yes.
And so because I think there's a part of the manuscript that does feel abysmal that you kind of just have to let spirit kind of spirit talk, right? Especially when you're doing like kind of historical stuff
Yeah.
or where you're looking back, you just have to allow that other thing to happen.
You said just a moment ago there's a part of the manuscript that feels abysmal. And I'm aware of that, where that word comes from, abyss, being like the abyss.
Yeah.
And I just want to clarify, do you mean the finished product feels abysmal, or the process? There's a process, and partway through the process, it feels like you're in an abyss.
Oh yeah, thanks for the clarification, or
Because
asking
I'm like, are you
for the
insulting your
clarification.
own manuscript here?
No. That's so funny. Thank you for that, for mentioning that. No, it was the creative process felt, or the writing process felt abysmal.
Okay.
Yeah, it felt abysmal. And so and going back again to what you were asking in terms of the creative process. So if I'm not, you know, doing all this other, if I'm not tapping into that brain that's a little bit less, I wouldn't say less intellectual, but more intuitive. And
Yeah.
so I'm kind of like juggling both. I have this part where I'll step into, which is much more intuitive, and then I'll go to this other part, which is a lot more, you know, it's more rational, more intellectual, it's more form making my own formulas in such a way.
Yeah.
And so, like, even two of the last or second poem I read, there's actually two quotes. They're not my words. It's the words of the writer, the Filipino writer Eileen Tabios, and then the other writer, who's a trans Jewish writer, Trish Salla, who I really love her work. And so, like, I also like to incorporate the other thoughts or voices or ideas or concepts of other thinkers and writers into my work. I think it's also part of being maybe in academia, you know, and trying to wrestle with the more formulaic research essay.
Yes.
And although it's something as a creative writer I don't necessarily have to do, I'm still, you know, in that world. And so in also working with the book, I'm also doing part of the research is also kind of scholarly research as well.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot in there that I wouldn't give to my first year writing students, if I was back teaching creative writing. You know, this is definitely like, these are the advanced placement kids, get these ones. There's room for all different kinds. You know, I think there's definitely well, like I said, you know, the beginning writer students need one kind of writing, and the AP students need another kind, you know, perhaps. I got my own thoughts just derailed. I think it's a bluebird outside my door right now, and you probably can't hear it, but it is chirping in my ear so loud, and I'm just like, I love nature, I love bird song, but I'm just like, come on, I'm doing a podcast here with a bluebird getting on my nerves. Oh, I think that's probably a good segue for me to ask about the two poems that you did read at the top of the interview. You know, which one of them, I want to know, do you feel came more easily, and which one do you think was a little more difficult? Why don't you tell me about the one that you felt was easy first?
Okay, yeah. When I saw that question, I was like, "Oh my God, that's a really hard question." And actually, I'm that's kind of cute. I'm glad there's a. I know it's annoying, but I'm glad there's like a bird present. It's kind of gives this interview some I don't know, some bird energy, bird
Bird
medicine.
energy. Yeah, absolutely. I saw this very off topic, but I saw a meme on Instagram that's like a picture of a woman in a flood water, and she's going down the flood water, but she's got an umbrella and she's in a canoe or something. And it's like the poet is the person in the flood water, the flood is the rest of the world, and then the canoe and the umbrella are a poem about a bird. And I'm just like, yeah, that is my life. Like, I feel like everything is chaos, but you know, if I can read or write a poem about a bird in the morning or before I go to bed, I feel like I've got a little canoe that will keep me afloat for the rest of the day. And
Yeah, I
I
love that
love that.
metaphor. Yeah, I totally love it. Yeah, get on that canoe for sure. I think it's necessary for all of us to have that kind of life raft there. Yeah. And you know, just focusing on the bird too, like even though I can't hear the bird noise, but I'm focusing on like a bird, like it's just kind of hopeful. So the mo I guess the easiest was so the first poem I read, Becoming a Mink Whale. I don't really know. That's so hard when thinking of a poem as easy, because the book was just so hard for me to write. It took many years, but also so difficult to revise, that I think maybe that piece came easy. The only way I can describe it is because it was the moment, and I'm trying to be truthful, like there are just moments I think that many writers can relate to, where I don't know if you had a good breakfast that morning, or you were able to finally take your morning walk and maybe do some yoga and meditation. Maybe astrologically it was supposed to be a really great day. It wasn't so hard on you, and you were actually able to write something and write a draft that felt good. It just felt good. It just some reason, right? And so, and it doesn't mean that Becoming a Mink Whale wasn't revised. It was revised, and thankfully it was also like the editors at Noemi kind of also like it kind of did some line edits on that. But it wasn't as edited as much as the others. And that poem was probably one of the older poems in the manuscript. But yeah, that was just one of those moments, if I can remember back. It was just one of those moments, and those moments you just have to thank. You just have to thank the ancestors or spirit. You don't even know if that poem is going to get published or whatever, but it just came. It sort of came, and it was one of those feel good moments, and sometimes we just have to write, like you said, like you feel like, like everything around you is like chaos, and then you have the bird, the bluebird, and you're on your in your canoe. That was the bluebird. It was like it felt good to write. I felt that my internal critics were on low volume. Hi cat, we're on low volume. And yeah, it just I allowed myself to just be receptive. Nothing, yeah, nothing,
That's a thing that I do really think about probably more than I think about poetry itself is how do we get into that, what Csikszentmihalyi, the researcher Csikszentmihalyi, would call flow. How do you get to that point where you silence the inner critic and you can really get into the poem? And I think, a lot of the research would basically say, like, well, yes, going for a walk in the morning can definitely help. Physical exercise. Michelle Bidding in our interview with her talked about like preparing the body for poetry. And I certainly think that going for a walk can stimulate, stimulate and also clear our heads and things. But also like finding a topic that just is engaging, where you're gonna have something to say about it and you can kind of enter the poem more easily. And that to me, that part is always mysterious. I'm like, I think I have a lot to say about the monarch butterfly, but then I'll start and just realize, no, I don't. There is like my elbow will itch, and all of a sudden I'm like, I have all these poems about itchy elbows just coming out of me randomly. And it's like, where did that come from? So that one's very mysterious, I think. So for people who may not know, and that includes me, what exactly is a mink whale?
It's a kind of whale. It's a kind of whale. I'm thinking, I'm thinking of the poet Rajiv Mohibir, who's also a dear friend of mine, who I'm reading. He's coming out with a new book called Whale Aria, and it's whales and whales. I would like The mink whale is a type of whale. It's a type of whale that migrates or travels very, very long distances. It's a type of whale that's also inhabits part of the Pacific that is near Southeast Asia and the Philippines. And so it's just a species of whale. And so I and why I was drawn to it at that moment, I think it was because of specifically like where the space in the world that it inhabits, but also for just in general, like the male's migratory qualities. Like so many species of whales, not only are they highly intelligent, sentient beings, but they travel, like, thousands of miles, right? They're in constant migration. And so because I would say because migration, because of, where, culturally, historically, where I'm from, and my experience as a first generation immigrant, and also as someone that travels, who is also a first generation immigrant and has, people in my life that are like, immigrants, migrants, overseas workers, this idea of just the concept and the idea of migration, and that's how it came to the whale. And so yeah, I hope that responds to your question. Yeah.
Have you ever seen a mink whale before?
Online, I have online. I haven't. I've seen another type of whale in person, other types of whales in person, but I've never seen a mink whale in person. Online, I have. I did a lot of research on mink whales and all kinds of whales, and it just seemed like the mink whale spoke to me because of its place that it continues to migrate to, and that made sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously like very fascinated with nature in general and also with whales in particular, and I don't know, spend a lot of time just like randomly looking up like odd facts about whales. So I mean,
Sure.
I completely feel you on that one. So I think
Yeah.
the next question then is tell me a little bit more about the difficult poem.
Oh, okay. But yes, you should definitely, I hope you get a hand on Rajiv Mohibir's Whale Aria when it comes out. I think it's coming out in the fall, so if you're into whales, this particular collection is amazing. Okay, so the hardest, well, again, I felt all the pieces in this book was very hard in its revision, and it was the journey that I wanted to be on. I had the opportunity to work with editors, and I wanted that experience. And so when I was rewriting or revising cut an opening to mend the me, it's actually a piece that, if I can remember, spans maybe a few pages. So it's a prose poem, so the lines are longer. They're also fragmented as well. And I think, well, one is I think any long poem is hard to write, not only if it's length, but also when one decides that they're going to make this poem longer. And so it was working with material that was coming from, let's say, what felt like multiple spaces, multiple directions, and having to bring it together into this longer piece. And the longer piece wasn't even the longer piece was actually published in I don't know if you know of Eohippus Labs. Eohippus Labs, Andrea Quaid, and oh, I'm forgetting names that I don't want to. I hope I get to email you these names. But they did this they did this conference or symposium many years ago. It was titled Emergent Feminist Pedagogies, and then they published these a set of really beautifully done chapbooks at the end. And so this piece, which actually even was re the title was revised, Cut an Opening to Mend the Me, that was revised, but it was me sort of working with chopping up these various essays. And so because of just its length, and I wanted this essay to be more of, again, like in the aesthetic of more like almost like a collage, almost like a collage, like a fragmented collage essay, that it was a difficult thing to do because you want it to look intentional. You know, you wanted you and relevant to, you want the pieces to be relevant to each other, but also you want to, or I wanted to bring another conversation, like a, like some kind of conversation or topic to the action that I was doing. And that's all just really hard in general. So it was really hard to write and then to finalize or revise that one piece. Because yeah, I think it's like about, I don't know if it's about seven. It's not, it doesn't sound long to like a fiction writer, but it was, I think it's like seven or something, 7 or 8 pages or something like that.
Well, so tell me a little bit about your revision process in general. I mean, it sounds like you have some great editors and some people who will give you feedback. But do you, when you are on your own, do you have a particular process or set of tools you use for editing?
Well, I definitely believe that there is not one way to edit or to go through the revision process. So with the manuscript, the way the things that I relied on in terms of editing was I revised and shuffled lines multiple times, just in terms of line edits. I revised and shuffled lines multiple times. I had my handy thesaurus next to me. I had stacks of like books that were that I was focusing a lot of my research on that were next to me. I also had a small stack of books of authors that I was, that I would look at their work and refer to them and see what they were doing, see how they tackled like a poem or a particular subject matter. So, looking at them as models, as models, I think it makes it even harder for writers to think that they have to reinvent the wheel because so many writers and so many people have already done it or are doing it, and you're also doing it in the process. So having other writers teach me was really essential to the revision process. I, went through the very the very traditional process of laying out pages on the floor, or like on the wall. I mean, I think that's still a really age-old effective, I think, technique when you can see that form, like when you see your pages, let's just say on the floor, and you can look at that from that sort of aerial or whatever.
Yeah, an aerial view. That's,
Yes.
I unfortunately have not really had that experience in a very long time because I was living in Costa Rica for 3 years and we didn't bring our printer with us because why would you? And since we've been back, we haven't really gotten printers. Everything's been so digital that I've
Sure.
had to like do without it. So
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the next time I put together a book, getting to try that aerial view. It sounds like people get a lot out of that process.
Yeah.
Oh, I had something too. I did have a question and it just left my little brain pan.
That's okay.
Oh, no. So talking about shuffling things around and playing with the order of things too, your book, this is something I've not seen in any other book, but you have, I'm pulling it up right now. Your book, I think, is divided into five sections. Is that correct? And each one of them has an interesting title, subtitle. The first one is, well, the first poem is Mercy Ceremony. And then we get into the first section, which is Confrontations, Earth Ephemera. The next is The Dead Teach Living. The next is To Hold These Contradictions in Kinship. And then the last one, I'm not reading that wrong. It is endlings, right? Not endings, but endlings.
Well, the after the dead teach living, actually the next section after that is titled Naked Strategic Partners,
Oh, I'm sorry. I
and it's
missed that.
okay, it's all right. And then afterward is To Hold These Contradictions in Kinship.
Okay. Yeah.
So the question what is like, how did I come up with those sections or?
Yeah, exactly. Like, were these notes for how you ordered the sections? What can you tell us about your thought process in terms of these sections?
Yeah, so I wanted to create a manuscript or a book where you don't have to read it from the beginning to and the end. You didn't have to start chronologically. That you could start in any place or any section first. And that's just because of my notion that that's just my notion in terms of like finding an alternative way to any kind of chronological storytelling, that there's more than one way to tell a story and to or to have an experience or to even like think about memory or to think about history, right? And so that's where that came about. So I wanted each section to be its own section, like whether it came first or last, but it was in, I mean, obviously I put it still in a particular order in terms of how if someone did want to read it from start to finish, but ultimately I wanted the reader, but also myself. It just made the most sense for me that one can just start, you know, in any section first and jump around. And so that there wasn't any fixed instructions in reading the book. And so and also that each of those sections there that they share some kind of themes together, themes, subject matters, voices, speakers, characters that they kind of lived there. They populated that area and were in conversation with each other.
Can you say something too about the lack of punctuation and the lineation? I am always really fascinated by this. I think at heart, I'm much more of a fiction writer, or I've gotten used to it, or maybe it just I was a good school student. I have it just so ingrained in my head. You capitalize things, you put in the periods, you put in the commas, you that's everything just goes from the right margin or the left margin to the right margin. So I'm always so enamored and awe, challenged sometimes by poems that are doing interesting things with line breaks. And all of your poems are doing interesting things with line breaks and punctuation and lack of punctuation. Can you talk a little bit about what you like about that and why you write in that way?
Yeah, so it this book like my in you know my last book All Things Lose, like I didn't write this way. I mean, I still have sort of like the dense language. I think there's definitely similar subject matter. It's like I'm interested in and I'm still interested in some of the same subject matter that I started with. But so this is the only book right now where I'm playing with, as well as also sticking to a kind of form that doesn't capitalize words and is uses punctuation really sparingly. And the reason I wanted to do that was, again, I was doing a lot of research on other writers who were thinking about, thinking about form, or thinking about form, who are thinking about hybrid literature, that are thinking about also like experimental poetics, like what is it that they're doing? Why are they doing this? And also having that conversation with myself, right? And I think poems can also have like a visual, some kind of visual aesthetic that also that I think is just as significant or as important as whatever concept or idea that you're working with. And it started to make sense to me to, let's just say, not capitalize any of the letters, almost because I didn't I was kind of kind of dism I'm trying to this sounds so academic here. It's sort of dismantling any kind of hierarchy, you know, in the English language. And so that small act, but also can like reverberate through or can say a lot and not capitalizing any of the words or any of the letters sort of did that for me. It did that for me. And also did that because I already knew that I was tapping into really s serious and also at times like difficult and brutal subject matter. So I was like, let's just keep these words and also how the words look on the page. Let's just keep them all sort of, I wouldn't say equal, but let's not capitalize any of them because there's already like a world that we're tapping into that can be quite intense,
Yeah.
right? And so I didn't want to, really highlight any words specifically that would give a lot of attention to them, unless maybe they were a quote or a
Yeah.
passage that I was actually citing from. So that was the reason I did that in terms of, and the same thing with like line breaks and any kind of like punctuation. I feel like the way one reads a poem can also be very different by from the way it looks like on the page. And there isn't
Yeah.
one way to present your work or one's work, my work. And so I in terms of like the manuscript, I was really thinking about the page, like how it would look, the how the form would look aesthetically and formally on the page, but also like how I could use it as almost like, I wouldn't say almost like visual. I think text can also be like a visual art, can have sort of
Yes.
like visual appeal and or sensibility. And so I was thinking about that. And at times I think grammar can be held, we can hold ourselves back. And also like looking at it, like how does a person who maybe didn't grow up or whose family didn't grow up with, English as let's say a first language, right? Like how do we work that into there? So I kind of just thought, I'm just going to dismiss all those things, work with physical form and then see what happens. And it seemed to stick. I also struggled with it myself. It was like even the process of writing it was a struggle, but I actually liked it and it worked for me. So yeah.
Yeah, as you say that too, I think you use the word brutality. In some ways, it's also like being a little violent with the language, like when you look at a sonnet or you look at something that's very measured, it looks like, an English garden, let's just say. They're all very manicured and structured. Whereas this is like taking it apart and disjointing it and taking out some of the formality and just, it looks like sentences that have been broken and kicked around a little bit. And that, kind of mirrors some of the, I guess, the feelings and the tones in the poem. It feels like these are poems written about and for and by voices that have been, are fighting back against something.
I love that. I really love your I really love that insight that you have and how you compared it to this English garden that's very manicured. I just love that. So as you're explaining it, I was just like, yeah, that's it.
I mean, and I absolutely wasn't really thinking about that until this discussion. So, I mean, I think I'm feeding off of that. And then there are some that are a little bit more controlled. Not a lot. I think there's one poem in here that looks like it's got, kind of a formal measured stanza that comes in the first or second, section. The other thing I wanted to ask is, and this I've never really encountered in a poetry book so far, but there's this image, this repeated image at the section breaks. Could you say what it is? Because I'm struggling to describe it exactly.
You mean the actual image, the visual art that's in
Yes,
there?
yeah, the visual art that's in there.
So there's a bit of a story that goes back to it and that goes with that question. So those pieces that recur throughout the manuscript is a collaboration, is a it's also said, I believe it's also mentioned in the endlings, I'm not sure, but it's a collaboration with myself and an artist who is also my partner, Claudia Torres Ambriz. And we sort of collaborated together on creating this image plus text kind of broad, like broadside, like pieces that move throughout the book. And that was something that was, because it's collaborative, it's not an idea that I came up with myself. It was as I was revising the work, painfully revising the work and having a very difficult time revising, and also thinking to myself, there is another wall that I could push even more. Or like you said, like there's something else in the garden that I can challenge or critique or deconstruct. There's something else that I could do here. And I did not know what. And my partner at this time, I'm still my partner, but at the time, like a couple of years ago, was like, "What you need? Why don't you go back to doing your art again to help you figure this out?" Because I studied art, as I mentioned earlier. I did my bachelor's in the fine arts, and so I used to do a lot more like hands-on things, like especially even through my creative process, I used to do more like drawing or collage work or anything like that. And so I was like, yeah, that's a good idea. And so as I started to do that, I was like, why don't we just collaborate together? But also because I was so fascinated by a sculpture. So that piece on the ground, which is a kind of a workman sculpture that's been stuffed like by, I don't know, like hundreds of pounds of silica sand. And so that was actually a sculpture that was an installation that they created many years ago. And it was one of my favorite sculptures that they did. And it was just really relevant to me because of, who the artist was, but also that, that this body was weighted on the ground. It like it was a kind of almost a kind of response to mental health, to the weight, to struggle, that I wanted to rebirth it. I wanted to give it life again. And I said, let's just start playing. And I'm a fan of series too, when like you see a recurring image throughout. And so I was like, let's play with this. And I wanted to create something with the very first poem, Mercy Ceremony, that the book starts with. And so we started to create various types of images of this sculpture that has been maybe destroyed many years ago, and bringing it back to life. So it was a really more emotional collaboration with my partner, who was also an artist, obviously, but it was, let's just say, it was a collaboration between two artists. And so to like give this piece, or this sculpture that was, originally this three-dimensional thing, and bring it back to life in another kind of form, which it looks on in the page like this almost like ethereal, almost like genderless, being, right? That I wanted to work with it and just go with it. And the rest was, I wouldn't say it was intuitive, but in terms of the placement and whatnot, and when I was thinking, should this be in here or not, I just was like, let's just put it in there. Also, I was working with the landscape form, in terms of the book is, in landscape format, and it just felt right to kind of work within again this series of this, and being also like an inter whether we want to call it interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary. I wanted to incorporate like another medium into the book that made sense, that made sense in some kind of way with the text in there.
And for, obviously people are listening to the podcast, you're going to have to get the book and you're going to have to go take a look at the image itself. It looks like it's a workman's uniform, work person's uniform that has been, it's interesting now finding out it's stuffed with sand because it's, you can sense the heaviness of it, that it's not being stuffed with feathers or whatever, but then it's also missing the full arms and no neck, no head, no feet. So it's just like this torso that's heavy lying on the ground. It looks like it's been pushed out of a window. But that it never had a head or arm. I mean, it's just so intriguing and ghost-like, but still really rooted with that heaviness. So I can see how it's playing with the text itself and encountering it over and over. And each time it's something a little bit different is very, very intriguing. Yeah, I realize also we're getting towards the end here. In fact, we're about ready to go over, which always happens. But I wanted to say again, to our listeners, the book is Nature Felt But Never Apprehended. And yeah, as you can tell, there's some interdisciplinary, some visual art here that we've been discussing that you're just going to have to get the book in order to be able to read it and see that artwork, so you can understand better what we're talking about. And also the visuals of those poems. I like I said before, I owe myself a second reading of this. And I'm so delighted, Angela, that you've given me a little bit of the backstory and a little bit more of your thought process that I can have informing me as I go through the second reading. It is a very layered book. It requires, and I don't mean that in a negative way at all. It demands, it will reward a reader who takes the time to go for a second or a third reading. And so I want to say thank you for that, for creating a book that is thoughtful and has so many layers for us to contemplate.
Thank you so much, Trisha. It was a pleasure to be on your podcast, to talk with you, to be in conversation with you. I really love how and appreciate how these questions sort of opened up these other places so that we can be in conversation with together. And yeah, I just had a really good time. So thank you so much.
You have been listening to the Poetry Salon Cast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. If you enjoyed this interview, you can find out more about the events we offer, the workshops and editing services that we host online, and a variety of other ways to get involved with the Poetry Salon by going to www.thepoetrysalon.com. You can also become a member of our free Facebook group, The Poetry Salon Online, and you can also find me, Trisha Faye Hefner, at Poet Trisha on Instagram. Thanks for listening.